Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Super exciting.
I know. Oh my gosh.
I know. I haven't seen you in so long.
I know.
My little Rachel. Anyway, guys, if you could believe it, welcome to the OC Bitches. We are back just in time to not only celebrate our 20th anniversary, finally we can talk about it, of this wonderful show, but the book release of Welcome to the OC, written by legendary TV critic Alan Sepinwall and our captains, creator Josh Schwartz and executive producer Stephanie Savage. This book is on sale now.
Oh my gosh. I know. It's so exciting. Welcome to the OC is the definitive oral history of the OC with interviews from the cast and crew. It's a behind the scenes look into how the show was made, the ups and downs, and its legacy today. This is the book that fans have been waiting for and is the perfect gift for Chrismica. Hello. We have an exclusive offer for our podcast listeners. Go to hc.com/welcometotheoc and buy the book from HarperCollins. Enter the code THEOC for free shipping and 15% off at checkout.
And with that, let's actually reintroduce, because he's back, our guest is none other than the great Alan Sepinwall. Alan is Rolling Stone's chief TV critic. He is among the preeminent writers about television of the last 25 years and author of multiple acclaimed books on the medium, including The Revolution Was Televised, Breaking Bad 101, and the New York Times bestsellers TV, The Book, and The Sopranos Sessions. Welcome, Alan. It's so exciting to have you here.
I'm so glad that we're able to do this. It wouldn't have felt like a proper book launch if I wasn't able to come back for it.
I know. The strike ended just in time, right? It was such an odd thing not to be able to talk about something so passionate, especially when we hit our 20th anniversary, August 4th, right?
Yes, August 4th? 5th, I think.
5th, sorry. August 5th. 5th. Well, I just have to tell you that I zipped through this book. It was so fascinating because... I'll just start with the idea that I think my first thought really quick is that Rachel, you know, we rewatched and broke down every episode and we talked about the characters and everything. This book covers everyone's emotions and creative behind the scenes experience. And it, for me personally, it just kind of put that last piece of the puzzle in for every curiosity I ever had about the behind the scenes. It's so good. Thank you so much for doing it.
Oh, I'm so glad. It's so great to hear that, like, it rang true to you, because it would have, you know, if I did this and everyone I interviewed read the final copy and said, no, this is nonsense, this is not what actually happened, I would have failed.
Well, I have to tell you two things. Josh Schwartz, like, every day was like, did you get the book yet? Did you get the book yet? And like, he's like, Mindy sat down and read it in one sitting. Did you get the book yet? And I was like... No, and I didn't get, was like the last to receive it or something. Anyways, but of course, it was such a quick read because it's just like, yes, hearing everyone's perspective and what everyone was going through and the people actually talking about it was amazing. And I think that's what people want. And it was just very exciting. And so I was thrilled to cram read this little guy right here.
It's so excellent. And it's so beautiful too. The cover and everything is they happen to be photos that Kelly Rowan took one day over a few days that she took, and we'll have to maybe ask her about those in detail. Or maybe you know how it came about, the photos.
Of
the
cover. Most of them are by Kelly. A couple of them not, but like, okay. I remember she sent me like the contact sheets, and I looked at them and said, "Wow, like she is. I mean, she's a great actor, but she's a great photographer too. This is beautiful stuff."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Rachel, I wanted to tell you, actually, I didn't read this. I just got this. It was a PDF, and I was traveling for 2 days on a plane. So I had nothing to do but ride a plane, be on a plane flight and read. So,
okay. To be fair. You did good. You're always better than I am. So that was very impressive. No. Really quick. Sorry. I just want to say, I didn't realize that I cursed so much. And as I'm reading it, I'm the only person that, like, there are F-bombs just, like, left and right. And I'm like, this is wonderful. This is now documented for life that I personally cannot say anything but fuck.
Well,
so that's great.
I will say, I'm not going to name which one, but of Josh and Stephanie, one of them did curse a lot in the initial interviews. And then when they read my first draft, they said, could we tone this way down, please? So you were not alone.
Great. But I wish I could have said, hey, can we tone down some of my fucks? Because that would have been wonderful.
I was actually going back over it because I was traveling yesterday as well. So what else are you going to do on a plane? And I did notice actually Stephanie was the one that had a lot more of the F-bombs, at least from, and that was an observation I made yesterday, but he's silent.
I'm saying
no
nothing.
Comment. No comment.
No good would come of me answering that.
Oh. So why don't we start at the beginning about the inception of the book and how this all came about?
All right. So as we talked about, I think the last time I was on, 20 years ago, I wrote this book called Stop Being a Hater and Learn to Love the OC. And this I wrote in about 3 weeks because the publisher was eager to get something on the shelf about the hottest show on television. And I had all sorts of restrictions on what I could and couldn't include. And so while it was my first book, I was never super happy with it. And then one day, Josh emails me out of the blue and says, hey, the 20th anniversary is coming up. We're thinking of doing an oral history. We think we can get the whole cast to do it. We would love for you to write it. And I said, of course, because it's, among other things, I love the show, but also it's a chance to like do it right this time.
Mm. Oh, how cool.
And yep. Oh, because the first time it was something you didn't have permission technically to do.
It was unofficial.
Copyright. Right.
Yeah. Every time I would like start describing too much of the plot, the editor would say, we're not sure you can do this. And so like a lot of the book is me talking around the show or doing things, you know, like I list every band whose music appeared in the course of the first season. I think there's a whole section just on graphic novels you might want to buy if you like Seth Cohen. So, which I know I'm sure would be your favorite part of the book, Rachel.
Of course, as you know.
Yes.
How does one go about just preparing for an oral history like this? You'd done it before with The Sopranos and Breaking Bad, correct?
Well, I'd done books on shows and I'd done a lot of interviews. I'd never done an oral history specifically. And so it became a case of like, what order am I going to talk to people in? And ultimately I decided, because Josh and Stephanie were part of the process, we would talk a lot before I went out to any of you guys so that I had... Because I thought I knew a lot of things, but I obviously didn't know everything. And so I wanted to have enough of a sense of the background so that like I could ask more informed questions. And because everybody said that they wanted a warts and all portrait, I wanted to know about specific things I could ask. And so I remember interviewing one of your co-stars and I brought up some incident, I think, from season 3. And they said, wait, are we allowed to talk about that? And I said, yeah, Josh and Stephanie told me all about it. And the fact that I knew about it seemed to give them permission. And so, you know,
what was the incident?
Something about like the cast gathered in a hallway being unhappy and like having a meeting because you guys were not crazy about the scripts. And by you guys, I mean the royal you, because one of the things I'm going to read it right now. This is on page footnote on page 174. It's important to note that whenever the topic of behind the scenes drama from the later seasons comes up, virtually everyone interviewed, other than Rachel Bilson and Melinda Clark themselves, reflexively added some version of, well, except for Rachel, and or except for Melinda. So whenever you read a quote in the book describing general ennui from veteran cast members, please mentally add, except for Rachel and Melinda, they were great.
Aww.
Yeah, that was...
there it is on 174.
Yep.
I think what's interesting that you were able to do, being a writer and a journalist, you clearly asked difficult questions that Rachel and I never felt in our podcast that it was appropriate to ask about those things necessarily, or unless it came up organically, because we were there celebrating each episode. So I thought it was interesting that you clearly asked some very tough questions and people answered. People were very honest and very, very brutally honest and truthful.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't looking to do a hatchet job. I love the show. You know, I like all of you guys. I've had good relationships with everybody over the years. But it was, I think it's a more interesting story if we talk about, like, the things that didn't work. If we talk about the times when, like, everyone wasn't best friends. About, like, because I think it's a book really about the show, but it's also, it could apply to a lot of shows. The idea of, like, nobody knows you, and suddenly you're famous overnight and you're on every red carpet and you're going to every party. And then a couple of years later, the show is not as popular, and sort of how do you deal with that? You know, and the show is great, and then maybe for a while it is less great, and you're telling stories about Johnny and Matt Ramsey, and sort of like the ups and downs and what it's like to just sort of be in a creative endeavor over the long haul. And I think, like, people really, because so much time had passed, they wanted to talk about it, and it felt cathartic in a lot of ways for them.
Right. How confident were you that you would get everybody to talk about it?
There were definitely times where I wasn't sure we were going to get certain people for various reasons. Ben was writing his crypto book at almost, I think our deadline was 3 weeks apart. And so he was the very last person I interviewed because he just didn't have time until then. And then there were a couple of other people who were reluctant, but eventually agreed to talk. And some were obviously more willing to be open than others. But for the most part, you know, having Josh and Stephanie being the ones to initially reach out and say, hey, we'd like you to do this if you can, that opened the door to me. And it also sort of made people more willing to, you know, speak from the heart as opposed to saying, you know, the messages that they should have had, you know, from 2005 or whatever.
There was one footnote, and I couldn't figure out what it was. There was a little footnote where Josh said, this is the worst thing that's going to come out in this book. And and Patrick Rush said, well, tell him to take it out. And Josh said, no, the shame needs to be out there. What was that about again?
All right. So it's again about Johnny. You know, every sort of bad road on the show somehow leads to Johnny. And apparently Patrick Rush said that they had Sebastian Stan in to read for Johnny. And Josh and Stephanie looked at the tape and said, no. And Josh and Stephanie denied, like, when I reached out to them about this, I said, no, that didn't happen. And I showed them the email from Patrick, and they texted back on the group chain, like, oh my God, what is wrong with us? You know, with various emoji.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Mary Ballsmiths from our friends over at Manscaped. Ladies, the holidays are approaching, and what if I told you the perfect gift does exist? Santa's helpers have been working hard to bring you Manscaped's brand new Performance Package 5.0 Ultra for the man in your life.
Who doesn't love the gift of smooth balls? Featuring the new Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra Ball Trimmer. Watch all of his wishes and mistletoe kisses come true. The perfect mix of naughty and nice. Go to manscaped.com and use code OC20 for 20% off. Plus, free shipping. Get like Santa and slay the holidays this year with Manscaped.
Manscaped's Performance Package 5.0 Ultra is the ultimate bundle gift for your man. It includes Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra, the Weed Whacker 2.0 ear and nose trimmer, Manscaped's liquid formulations, and two free gifts.
Ladies, after he's groomed the candy cane, it's time to make sure he doesn't smell like reindeer with the Crop Smoother Aftershave Lotion and Crop Preserver Anti-Chafe Ball Deodorant. Once they touch his sack, he'll never go back.
The gift of Manscaped doesn't stop there. This bundle comes with two free gifts. Manscaped's Boxers 2.0 Premium Underwear and the Shed 2.0 Toiletry Bag. Jingle balls all the way.
Get 20% off and free shipping with the code OC20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code OC20.
Gift him Manscaped and unwrap your favorite present this year.
There's so many wonderful anecdotes. I mean, there's so many things in here that, for me, my perspective, I loved hearing from the executives, Yvette Urbina and Gail Berman, and just seeing that side of it that we did. We never got to explore that really on the podcast, and I had wanted to, but I thought it was really interesting to see how, just from my own personal, when we wrapped the show, I was always so curious about the fact that, you know, we had three different time slots and we were after American Idol, and then it moved to Thursday at 8 and then Thursday at 9. And what was going on behind, there was so much going on behind between Warner Brothers and Peter Roth and Gail Berman. And there was so much, and the fact that McGee didn't do the pilot, how big of a deal that was. Like, it really just paints so much more drama going on than what my experience was or what we just had in the experience of just the 4 years on set.
One of my favorite things in the book is regarding when you guys moved from Thursday at 8 to Thursday at 9, I talked to Fox's head of scheduling, Preston Beckman, and I said, well, why did you do that? And he says, to be honest, I don't remember. And then I told this to Peter Roth. He's like, well, gee, that's pouring salt on the wound right there. It's already a terrible thing. And the guy can't even, you know, as far as he's concerned, justify it all these years later.
Right.
It was so fascinating to see how we ended up on Fox even. I didn't know that of course, Peter Roth was like, we're the WB. We need to have this show. But they had too many others, I guess, at the time. And it was Gail Berman who championed the show so much that it needed yes. to be over at Fox.
And Gail also gave them the idea of like Sandy being a public defender and bringing, you know, Ryan in as a foster son because they hadn't figured out like how they were going to get him from Chino to Newport. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot going on there. And obviously the stuff about Warner Brothers and Fox together developing three different shows about star-crossed interracial romances
right.
and them saying to Josh and Stephanie, like, you can't do that because for whatever reason, they felt that three was too many. And then one didn't get on the air, and then Skin lasted for 5 episodes. So, and you ran for 4 years. So you beat them all.
Wow. You talk a lot about Skin in the book.
It's way more than I expected to. Like, it just kept coming up. You know, people would just, I'd be looking at these interview transcripts and saying, well, like, why are we talking about Skin again? It just kept happening.
Well, then again, go back, maybe tell us more about the process of actually putting the book together. What did that look like? You had an assistant as well doing interviews. I know from my experience, we sat down, we talked for a couple hours and yeah. we recorded it. And how was that process for you? And what was exciting or surprising about it?
Well, first I had to rewatch the entire show because I hadn't seen almost all of it in a very long time. Some episodes, you know, since they had aired. And so fortunately for the process of the book, less fortunately for me, I went through like a lot of health stuff last year and the year before that. And so like a great way to kill time in a hospital is to watch the OC. And mm-hmm. so I was able to get through all of the episodes. And then once I had them, me and my researcher, Oriana Schwint, started lining up interviews, figuring out who could talk to who, doing outreach. And then some people would then lead to other people. And again, for the most part, everybody wanted to talk to us. There was one publicist, again, I'm not going to name names, who turned out to be like really difficult and kept saying like, my client only wants to talk about current projects. And, you know, it's just really, I'm not going to say, I'll tell you guys off mic later on, but,
how weird.
Yes, but almost everybody else was eager to do it. Some people are just busier than others. Like Chris Carmack, I think, like it took a long time to get back to us because he'd just had a baby or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, for the most part, it was like, I watched everything. I talked to Josh and Stephanie a bunch. And then when that happened, we started scheduling these interviews and I was able to talk to you guys. Ideally, I would have done like 2 interviews with everybody. But in a lot of cases, I felt like I got what I needed in one. And so the only guy I talked to twice was Brody. And that was, and he reached
yeah,
out to me.
Surprising.
Yeah. Cause the first time, as you know, he has mixed feelings about the experience of doing the show.
Yes.
And, you know, and we talked and it was what it was. And then a month or two later, he said, you know what, like doing this and talking to Rachel and Mindy and Josh, like prompted me to go back and rewatch a few episodes. And it's like, it's jogged my memory. Let's talk again.
Oh,
and he
wow.
was much more expansive the second time, you know, more enthusiastic about the process, more enthusiastic about himself. Like he said the first time that, you know, and it's in the book that he really hates watching himself on the show and thinks he was terrible. And then the second time he said, all right, well, I looked at it again and I can sort of see myself as a young actor and I'm trying things and I can respect that,
yeah.
you know, and I don't know that I would do it that way now, but like, I kind of get what I was doing. And so I'm less mad at myself for it. So that was nice. Again, it was like a lot of different times where people were able to get catharsis out of finally like talking about it. And obviously they talked about having had that experience going on your podcast, like, and having the That's podcast nice. As well was this huge resource because it helped me like know who to reach out to, certain questions to ask. Like I knew right. to bring up Chris Pine's acne when I spoke to Patrick Rush.
Oh my God. It's so weird that was such a thing. Like even reading it again.
Yeah, and then Samira talks about how she had terrible acne. And so, like, you know, Chris Pine doesn't get dispensation. Samira does. You know, Hollywood is unfair. It's unfair to men, I think, is ultimately, you know, what it comes down to.
Is it unfair to men?
You know what's interesting? I had acne throughout that entire show. I always had something on. I just have always struggled with it. Only like now in my 50s is it kind of gone away. But I always had something going on. But so I you know, and it was when I was really, really young. I think I missed some stuff because of my skin as well.
Wow.
And the other thing organizationally, again, shout out to Mindy, is like anytime I did not have the right email or phone number for somebody, I would, you know, text you and like 30 seconds later, you would have the proper info for me because you just have kept up with everybody.
Well, and I'm going to shout out to Katie because in the background, if I didn't have that particular one, I would just shoot it over to Katie and she was on it and would send it back. And so we had a little system going on. So thank you, Katie. Yeah. Our producer.
Yeah, for several people, like Josh and Stephanie had like email accounts from internet service providers that no longer exist because it had just been so long.
Who did you want to get on and just didn't?
There are three. One is okay. Pratt. Pratt is, as you might imagine, somewhat busy being Chris Pratt. Olivia Wilde. The problem was basically the entire time we were doing interviews overlapped perfectly with the press cycle for Don't Worry, Darling. And which just kept getting crazier and crazier. And so every time it seemed to be calming down and we said, okay, now is the time to do the outreach. Something new would happen. And we're like, okay, no, Olivia is not going to want to do an interview right now. And so we just missed the window there. And the last one is I wanted to talk to one of the guys from Rooney and I was just never able to connect with them.
Yeah.
But it turned out Alan Heinberg, one of the writers on the show, is now friends with the guys from Rooney. So he was able to offer some secondhand perspective from them.
Oh, fun.
Okay. Well, there you go.
There's so many wonderful tidbits because you would think that after doing the podcast for a few years, like there's nothing new we could learn. And there's so much. I'm telling you guys, there's so much in here. And I was, especially because I think as actors, we know that we don't always talk about these uncomfortable or awkward or just, you know, we're private, right? We don't talk about all these things. And I think it just shows there's so much reflection, a mature reflection. And when we talked, we're going to talk to Josh and Stephanie, there were so many revelations from them that I'd never heard about very specific moments. And I can imagine that you had hours and hours and hours of interviews with people and you had to somehow edit it down to this book. How much is left out?
I don't think there's the original draft that I turned into the publisher was 500 pages. This is about 400. And so they said like, we don't want it to be a doorstop. We want it to be something that, again, as you guys said, it reads quickly and can fit easily in your hand.
Yeah.
And so I chopped out a lot of stuff. The main thing was there was a whole chapter about like the OC and comic books, which now is like, you know, a couple of pages in the chapter on season two.
I appreciate that.
Yes, I thought you would. You know, your ambivalence about the medium is quoted in that section. But in terms of larger anecdotes, I don't think there's anything that like, we were really excited about that we cut. It's more like you tell a story and then three different people offer their reflections on it. And so now it might be two people or one person as opposed to three. So it was more like cutting out some of the duplication, even though it seems sort of nice that you could have like lots of different people. One of my favorite things is the story about Doug Liman in the pilot, because he was doing pre-production on Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
All the Doug stuff. It's my favorite. Sorry.
So he's shooting. You guys weren't there, but he's shooting Seth and Ryan on the boat in the pilot. And he's on another boat with the camera and he realizes he's late for a meeting for Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So he turns to like the DP and says, "You've got this," jumps off the boat, swims to shore to get to the meeting. And Josh and Stephanie tell me this. I'm like, okay, this is a tall tale. I'm going to talk to Doug. Doug is either going to significantly downplay it or just outright deny it. And Doug says, no, I did that. You know, they knew what they were doing. I didn't have to stay there.
Yeah, he's like, it seemed like the quickest way to get to shore.
Yeah, and then I talked to Dave Bardas, Doug's producing partner. He says, no, I've seen Doug jump off a boat like five times. It's just that's the way Doug rolls. And so
he looks for a reason.
Yeah, so every time I thought someone was telling like a fish story, I would then get like five confirmations of it. There was almost nothing that someone said that was not backed up by anyone else. And when that did happen, I just didn't use it. So
you know, there's so many times where like there were a few quotes from me that I remember, you know, saying and then thinking like, is it true though? And I really could tell that you made everything that was said, you checked it out. Did you not?
Yes.
You did.
Yeah, I would run things by Josh. I would run things by Stephanie. I would run things by other actors. There were, even though I talked to everybody pretty much only once, there was a lot of emails and texts going back and forth. You know, Rachel, I checked with you about like the exactly what Brody said when he was clapped out at the end of season four. So, you know, I was just doing all of these things and people remembered as best they could. Because there was a couple things where like somebody would try to take credit for something they didn't do. And if nobody else remembered them having done it, then that didn't go in, that sort of thing.
Did you find that when there were particular stories or episodes, you know, incidents or just certain memories that you wanted to know about, did they generally, when you talk to people, did, or just as us as actors, did everyone tend to have the same story, or were there different versions of it? I'm always curious because people have different perceptions of how things happen.
No, there's definitely a lot of that, you know. People have different perceptions of certain things that went down, about certain people. You know, Misha's mother is obviously a character in the book. There's a lot of differing perspectives on Nuala and sort of her role in Misha's career and life at that point. You know, perspectives on certain episodes. There was one director who, that like somebody remembered him as being like really close to Ben. And then, you know, someone else is like, no, they couldn't stand each other. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. Yes. I see you guys shaking your heads right there, but it's, you know, different people remember things differently. And as often as possible, I tried to present the most common thing. And when people strongly disagreed, but in a way that wasn't necessarily provable, then I would kind of try to present both perspectives.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting, you know, you get into, I mean, so the book is formatted by season, correct?
Yes, largely. Yeah.
And so the season one is just this, I guess it's a honeymoon phase of the series.
Yeah.
And season two, you start, you know, there's a little bit less of that. And then I guess what even on our own podcast, season three was the least popular, but I got to tell you, it's the juicy, season three is the best chapter or part of this book because it's, you spent a lot of time really, really exploring.
Getting into it, yeah.
Yeah, and again. In
bizarro world, you called it, right?
No, and nobody hid from it. Like Brody, you know, you bring up all of the things that he was, that other people said he was doing that year. It's like, no, I did that. You know, I can't defend it, but I did it. You know, or, you know, it's like, look, I should have been trying harder, but I wasn't. But I also wasn't mean to anybody. And I guess that's sort of, you know, what my takeaway from it was. And it's Josh admits like he started hiding from you guys because he was so embarrassed by the material. I mean, Rachel, like, is that something you were even aware of at the time?
Josh is always hiding from me, so it's not. I don't really remember that. You know, as we know, my memory's not the best. But I just loved that it really dived into the whole thought process and what was going on in season three and the decisions with, you know, the big ending and how that all went down and hearing from every different person's perspective about it. I thought that was like one of the most interesting things.
And I will say, like, the chapter on Misha's exit, Marissa's death, like, that was the most surprising thing I reported because, you know, there was all this gossip and rumors at the time about why it happened and was she fired? Did she quit? Was there bad behavior and all of that? And what the story that you guys all told me was not that at all. It was about, like, her, you know, because she was younger, never really feeling like she fit in, about the writers sort of running out of material for her, about them ultimately decide, like, about the network saying, like, you've got to kill someone off and we would prefer it to be Marissa. And then the producers, like, being too afraid to actually talk to Misha about whether she wanted to leave. It was sort of it was this whole cascade of things.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcast FREE.
You know, I will say, like, a lot of it was talking about her not fitting in and being younger and whatnot. And I don't totally, I definitely, like, at least the first season, everybody hung out and was together. And Misha, like, we were all hanging out, doing everything together. I think more so than her being younger, I think it just shifted once, you know, the show blew up and she blew up, and you touch on it, and the boyfriends and the people and the things. Yes. I think that was more the disconnect than, you know, her being younger, just not fitting in. And Stephanie touches on it in the book where she talks about us all hanging out and Misha kind of being her own island and doing her own thing and looking back, wishing she could have, like, walked over and invited her to join, and how it's just so interesting how you see things one way and then looking back and reflecting, and maybe with maturity or reflection or whatever, you look back and you're like, I would have handled this differently.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of that throughout that chapter and really throughout the book. Like, you know, if we all had a time machine, we would do things differently. And when you're making as many decisions as a showrunner is making on a TV show, or as an actor is making, when you're doing 27 episodes 1 year, 25, 24, you know, it's a lot. You know, you're not going to get everything right. Nobody is.
Right.
Yeah. I really do appreciate the, you can tell, because doing the podcast, I would research all the interviews that Josh did, or try to find the, you know, the back interviews, and they have never, Josh and Stephanie have never been as honest than in this book, and expanded the experience. And now I totally understand when Josh said doing this podcast was like therapy, because now he really did open up his experience to everyone. The fact that he was so young and friends with everyone, and the fact that the studios were worried about that was like an issue, I guess. But the voice is of people just on a journey in life, learning the lessons and accepting that certain things happen that they, if it were to happen today, would do it differently. And I think that's what life is about. I think that it's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just is what happened. And I think exactly what you said, Rachel, I kind of see it now, is that, yes, there's that honeymoon phase where everyone is having so much fun. And there's still the one thing that really, really became very, very poignant and striking to me is just, because I didn't work as much as you guys, but just how exhausted and exhaustion can have a toll on your quality of life. And I think that's one of the number one things that Misha was going through. And, you know, there was no day off. She said she had 6 days off and you don't have time to do all of these. You're being pulled every which way. So being that imperfection is, you know, what being a human is about, right?
Yeah. And I remember when she flew to Ireland for one night, like it was like a 48-hour trip to go to Ireland to that award ceremony and fly back and work. And it's just like thinking back, you know, when you're young, sure, like you can do that a little easier, but still that is so much to take on. And that was just constant.
Well, and I think that's the thing. That's what Norman would always say to me. And he'd say, Mindy, he was such a huge champion of her and he was so disappointed. And he says it in the book that he thought it was a very big mistake to have her leave the show. Mm-hmm. He just said, I could just see her on a daily basis, how tired she was. Mm-hmm. And you know, Rachel, I always remember Cindy, our makeup artist. Now they were there every day, all day long. You know, sometimes we'd work 4 days or 3 days, but our crew was exhausted. And it's tough. I don't think people really get, it's not a glamorous, there's no home life. There's a lot going on. Yeah.
No, I can't imagine now, like, you know, doing something like that, like you did, Mindy. I mean, obviously you're saying you didn't work as much, but having a young child or whatever, like it really is a lot and it's long hours. And Misha was so young and that's going to be taxing. It was taxing on everybody, but, and I'm not complaining, just to be clear, but it is another side of things that people don't, you know, get in trouble.
I was going to say, like, I've been on sets. I've visited sets a lot over my career. And back in the days when everybody was making 22 episodes a year on network television, I would like show up for a production and they were doing like episode 19 and everyone would be fried. The writers would be fried. The directors, the actors would be sort of like, wait, you know, what's my line? Where's my cue? Like, what day is this? Everything. That's episode 19. You guys made 27. that year. It's just, it's staggering to me that like you're still here to talk to me, you know, coherently 20 years later.
You know, what's that's a really good point that that you keep bringing up was also the budget, because in, you know, Fox, of course, had 90210, which technically to them is, I guess you guys make the point that soap operas or nighttime soaps have low budgets, right?
Yeah.
And so, but they did 34 episodes, I think, at one point. And so they had asked us to do 30, and it was Bob D who said, no, you just tell them no. And so the network kept saying low budget soap, get all, you know, let's get the Heather Locklears, let's get the Jeri Ryans, let's do the femme fatales, let's kill a character. They just wanted big storylines that could promote. And I do love the part where, you know, at one point, Stephanie was saying at the end that they were saying, you know, Peter Liguori took over and that it came to, it, she was told that this is a NASCAR network. And she was like, no, it's fucking not. It was The Simpsons and 90210.
And Ally McBeal, all of these very un-NASCAR things.
But they made a point about in the very beginning when they were creating the show that they explained the Trojan horse more to me in this book, right? Because the idea was that network wants 90210, but Josh and Stephanie love Freaks and Geeks and My So-Called Life. But they went, oh, those shows only lasted a year.
Right.
Yep.
I was like, oh, yeah. So these shows that are nuanced and have really, really intelligent humor don't always play to the masses or keep you on the air.
Yeah, so you put it in this glossier package. You don't try to hide the fact that, like, your cast is gorgeous. You know, you put it in this more opulent setting as opposed to, you know, suburban Detroit in 1980 or whatever. And, you know, and they were able to do all of these great things for quite a long time before, you know, the wheels started to come off and the network started, like, demanding things that were just ridiculous.
Right. I'd like to see a version of this show in suburban Detroit in, like, the 80s. I mean, I feel like that would be...
Yeah.
I'd be entertained.
Yeah. I was, you know, I had known that they were not so, they weren't quite sold on the Seth idea, but I didn't realize in the development how much Gail was like, guys, I don't like this Seth Needleman guy. There's so much that we never, and how they made some adjustments and really going into detail about how the show was developed. That was really satisfying as well.
Yeah, I love Josh's anecdote about how, like, first of all, they auditioned like every guy who lived in the house with Brody. But then on top of that, they brought in like one actor. His name was Aaron something. I'd have to check it in the book. But like Josh describes him as, quote, Bar Mitzvah Josh. And sort of that was like the initial idea they were going for. And Gail Berman's like, no, we do not want Bar Mitzvah Josh.
Oh my God. Oh, poor little Bar Mitzvah Josh. But then it had like all the prototypes for the people that they saw playing these characters. I think it was Jason Schwartzman was the prototype for Seth, you know, and I forget who.
Josh Hartnett was supposed to be
Josh
Ryan.
Hartnett. And then, and then reading about like who almost were the people. It's just so crazy like to think like what the show would have been like, would it have been the same had other people been cast?
Right. Yeah. And Gail Berman was like, I had no idea. I just, you, when you read stuff about yourself, you're like, what? Stephanie was like, we really wanted to hire Melinda for Fastlane, but the reason was the network thought I'd be too old by the time the show ends to run a division. 'Cause I was 33 and they wanted somebody in their 20s because they think a woman in their 20s is running a secret division of the LAPD. And I was, and actually Peter Roth told me to my face, he said, I wanted Tiffany Amber Thiessen. She had a name. I mean, so you get different versions of things, but it's a kind of a unique experience to read all of this.
It's such a strange business. Like Ben McKenzie, UPN wouldn't approve him to play the fifth lead of a pilot on the sixth place network. And then like a week later, he comes in and he becomes the star of your show.
Because he wasn't a star in their eyes, whoever those people were. I think there's how many times in your life have you been told, you know, or even Gail Berman said, Melinda probably would have had a harder time in casting had we not been guest stars. Because if you make them series regulars, then that's just the formula. They want to go for names or such. So Rachel and I were lucky, I guess, by being guest stars from the beginning.
Yeah, I think I was like a co-star. I had like a couple lines and I'm like, listen, guys, this is the way into anything. Minimal work to achieve maximum.
You
yeah.
know, I don't know if it's important for me. I don't even know. It doesn't really matter because it works. There was one timeline that was incorrect, but it doesn't matter.
Okay, tell me, please.
Call him out. Maybe.
Well, the Peter Camp Gallagher happened after season one. And we went to the upfronts because I wasn't invited to the first upfronts after the pilot.
Okay.
And it was, but it's correct. We had all bonded for a year, did the first upfronts with the entire cast, and then went to Peter's. So it was after the first year.
If there's like an updated edition at some point, I will try to fix that. But I have to leave in the story about Peter saying, again, this is sort of different people have different perspectives. Peter tells the story of like, you know, we were playing, you know, touch football or something. And I ran over, you know, Captain Flag. I ran over Ben. I was worried. Oh, my God. I've just like, you know, brutally injured the star of our show. And I tell Ben that and he just kind of smirks and laughs. He's like, OK, Peter, I played high school football with Drew Brees. I was fine. But let him think he's a big man. OK.
That was an epic highlight of that was probably the epitome of us just having truly one of the best weekends, I think, as a cast.
Oh, yeah. And I even remember it. So it had to have been something.
Yeah. I remember your Mutant Ninja Turtle.
I know. When you blew monologue. My mind with that, because of course I didn't remember that, but apparently I can recite many facts about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So you're welcome, everybody.
Also, I have to apologize for something said on my last appearance. You guys hadn't gotten to season four yet, and I talked about, like, how we were eventually going to get to the episode where Summer is in like the beaver costume or the otter costume or whatever. Yeah. And you, Rachel, you didn't remember it. And the reason you didn't remember it is because you're never in it in the episode. We only see Taylor in it, which I didn't realize until I went back to rewatch the show to write the book. So,
oh my God. Even you saying that now, I'm like, huh?
Yeah.
What?
Yep.
I don't know. I was going along with it. I was like, oh yeah.
No, Summer dresses up in the costume, but it's entirely off camera. We never actually see her do it. They just talk about it.
So, I feel like I would remember putting that costume on.
Yes.
Yes, for sure. Oh my okay. gosh. All right. Well, I accept your apology.
So sorry.
Yeah, I just think it's going to be so fun for people to really get this side of things because I know, and what's so cool is that the show still resonates with people so much and the fan base and everything. And I think to have this opportunity to really get in there, hear from the people who actually were in it, making it behind and front, is just such a cool experience.
It was always a curiosity in when the day we wrapped, people would ask me about it and I'd say, I don't know, someday. I actually would say, someday, I called it a forensic journalist is going to go in there and write some Shakespearean-like epic drama behind the scenes. And in this moment, I'm realizing you just did. You just did it.
Alan Sepinwall, forensic journalist. I'm going to get it put on my business card.
I don't know if that's a thing. Well, yeah. No, I mean, you got so many things. There were a couple moments that were kind of vague, you know, then I was like, ooh, what's more to that story? Like I wanted more from the story, but it was also respectful.
Who do you feel was the most open, quote unquote?
I mean, Josh was the most, Josh and Stephanie were the most open.
But out of the cast.
Yeah, I mean, you guys all were, Autumn was very, you know, Mindy, you were talking before about like being introspective. Autumn Reeser like really sort of got deep in her feelings about like just sort of what it was like to come into the show late. Everyone was like super nice to her. And yet she felt like I don't really belong here because I wasn't part of like when the show was this big hit and the sensation and everybody was hanging out. And so she's sort of like, you know, doing her best and getting along, but also like she really opened up about that in a way I was not necessarily expecting.
Yeah, I really had an empathy there when she expressed that the first season must have been this magical thing. And she said, I went from being in an acting class to being on this amazing TV show. And as lovely as it was, she could tell that not everybody was having that same joyous experience she was. And you know what? I do want to make a point that it has happened, and it's not just on the OC, that there are these honeymoon phases where everyone's so excited to be there. And if it's a fourth season or whoever, you know, there's negative energy is contagious and it can permeate through an entire set. So she felt that, she felt kind of like she had missed out on some of that exciting. I never saw that from her, but she did express
very
that.
Very professional. Yeah.
No, and every, I mean, like I said, Brody, you know, copped to everything. He didn't always remember things, but he never said like, oh, you know, I wouldn't have done that. There was one interview, and you can read between the lines when you read the book who it was, where they were much more guarded than everybody else. But almost, you know, 99.9% of everyone I interviewed was willing to talk about anything and everything. Yeah. And that was, you know, that made writing the book itself so much easier because I didn't have to like piece things together and sort of, you know, paint between the lines or anything.
I'm surprised by some of my comments. I'm like, I said that?
Well, I thank you for saying that.
Rachel, you are the queen of the one-liners, the what do we call them in the press? The
how about foot and mouth?
Well,
no, clickbait, whatever.
No, it's what is that term? I just lost it. Like
soundbite?
Soundbites.
Your
sound bites. You're very good at that.
Yes, and I do it intentionally, clearly. So
yeah.
It's wonderful.
I did think that there were a couple things that were, I did think it was interesting at the end. You know, I had never thought about that dynamic of like Peter Gallagher being the senior cast member and Josh being, you know, this young man and having, and Bob DeLaurentis was like, it's no match for the young Josh to the senior. And I had never thought of it in those terms. And at the end, Peter had leaned over and said, one day we'll talk about all, what happened. And Josh was like, what does that mean? And I would have liked to hear that conversation. But it's a treat.
Oh my God.
No, it was really, and there were a number of times where like in doing these marathon interviews with Josh and Stephanie, they would tell me a story. And right before they said it, they said, we're not sure if this should go in the book, but we'll tell it to you for now. And when it eventually came time to put it all together, I, you know, sent them all of them and said, do you have any problems with these? And every single one of them ultimately wound up in the book. So there was nothing where they ultimately felt like we need to hide this.
Right.
Yeah. Which hasn't been the theme over the past 20 years, has it? There was some guarding going on to the experience. So maybe it's just because it takes as much time as it takes when people are ready to talk about it.
Right.
And it really did help that you guys had been doing this great podcast and you'd had everybody from the show on. And so the show was fresher in their memory than it would have been if I was coming to them cold, but also like they were used to the idea of talking about it. They had already sort of, you know, gone through their feelings again about what it was like. And so it was, again, you guys made my job easier, not just by being great interviews, but by having done this mammoth endeavor yourselves.
So glad we could help. Yeah, I think when you go through something, sometimes maybe the fear that you think you have behind something goes away and you feel safer. I think we've learned quite a bit about ourselves. All of it. And it's been a wonderful journey.
It has been a wonderful journey. I want to say one more thing. I refer to Adam, I use the word dick a lot.
Okay. Yes.
I'm like, dickish, you dick, this, that. And reading it back, I'm like, I use that a little too much. He was not, okay? It was, and I say it in the book about a sense of humor can come off a certain way or his actions, but I was just like, I didn't need to use that adjective quite so much.
I think your affection for Brody, even now, comes across very strongly throughout the book.
Oh, good. Because I do. I love him dearly. Always will.
Yes.
And I use that word a lot. And I just wanted to, since I have the platform.
Of course.
Say, it was used a little too much. Thank you for
next time I will run all of the profanity by you, Rachel. I promise.
Please, for fuck's sakes.
In the second printing, we'll do a few more footnotes after talking to Rachel. I think that would be interesting, though. I mean, I still think it's fascinating to get everyone's reaction to the book. I think that's a whole new, interesting experience.
We're talking, it's still like 12 days before the book comes out when we're recording this. Mm. And so the thing I've sort of been like living in, maybe not fear, but anxiety about is, everyone I've talked to has my email. Many of them have my phone number. And I'm just sort of terrified, like, as they start getting the book and reading the book, me getting a series of angry emails, texts, and phone calls from people who feel like they were misrepresented. This is not how it happened. You should put this in. That was unfair that this person said to me. And like talking to you guys, and obviously the both of you come off incredibly well in the book, but still talking to you guys and hearing you say that it feels like this is what really happened, other than the Camp Gallagher timeline thing, that makes me feel good. And it makes me at least slightly less neurotic about, you know, checking my inbox over the next couple of weeks.
We're here to ease your anxiety.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Yeah. I mean, it's still like nothing is perfect but everyone has a different perception, you know? It's like there could be a sentence where I say, but I also said this that wasn't included in the book, you know? But I think you guys did a really wonderful job of blending all of these interviews, because it must have been just this huge, huge challenge to take all the interviews, getting people talking about it, and then deciding which quotes about that particular subject you're going to use.
And the goal was always, like, you got to give things enough context, because you don't want it to just be the clickbaity quotes.
Right.
So if Rachel is, for instance, talking about like Adam not necessarily behaving at his best in one season, you want to make sure that you're also including like the things around that where Rachel is talking about like how good he still was on camera in spite of that. Things like that. Like, even when we had to trim the book down about 100 pages, I was always very conscious about leaving that context in. It just meant like I would have to drop a quote from somebody else as opposed to shaving down this one. And so it lost all of its original meaning.
I really appreciate that.
I do too. And I think that, you know, to paint the picture that we're talking about real things that happen in life and behind the scenes of stuff, there was never screaming or arguments or unprofessional. You've heard horror stories on sets and such. There was just, we spend a little bit of time in when the camera rolls, it's a very small bit of time. There's hours and hours and hours behind the scene of just organic life happening. And I don't think that, but it, in this respect, though, the show was very professional, regardless of the feelings and the, you know, the confusion of the writers in some of the seasons and what to do with this baby that they're trying to garden and nurture. And it still was just a very wonderful experience and still very professional. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
everyone was always professional. Everyone was where they needed to be, when they needed to be there. You know, all of those things were always true, no matter how anyone was ever feeling.
Yeah, right.
And the thing is, I talked to so many people, and a lot of them were very much in I don't give a fuck mode. Like, I will say anything. I'm no longer being guarded. So if these terrible pieces of like diva behavior or tantrums or whatever had happened, someone would have told me about them. Three people would have told me about them. And repeatedly, that kind of stuff did not come up in any conversation I had.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of, you know, this book is for the fans. And there's been a lot of like speculation about things that go on. And I hope that maybe this is the definitive answer to some of those questions, because it definitely made it much more clear in my mind of how things happened. Yeah.
So I think, Alan, before we let you go, maybe you could give us like a 30-second little recap spiel pitch on why everyone should go buy this book.
Okay. So welcome to the OC, the oral history, written by me in conversation with Josh Schwartz, Stephanie Savage, and the cast and crew, including my two lovely hosts here. I talked to everyone in the regular cast who was ever like in the opening credits of the show. I talked to producers, directors, writers, members of the crew, executives at the network, executives at the studio, guest stars, members of the bands who appeared on the show, you know, producers of reality TV shows that only exist because of the OC. Like, you guys are either, you know, get the credit or the blame for the entire Real Housewives franchise. Like, Julie Cooper, without her, there are no Housewives. So I talked to those people. It is a soup to nuts portrait of the show you love. Everyone was incredibly honest. Like, it's a warts and all portrait. It celebrates all of the things that were so wonderful about the show. It does not flinch away, however, from the parts that didn't work, both on screen and off. So you're really going to get the entire portrait of what it was like. And, you know, Melinda and Rachel both said that it feels like the experience they had. So, you know, you can trust them even more than you can trust me.
Beautiful.
Well said. Well said. Yes. Congratulations. Thank you. Thank you for doing this. My inner child is definitely satisfied.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
My actual child, when she's of age, can read it, except for profanity. So
absolutely.
Thank you for that.
You know, I've got a couple kids floating around the house, and every now and then I will see one of them pick up the book and start skimming it, and they're saying, maybe I should wait until I've watched it. So at a certain point, I will get them to do it.
Oh, amazing. Well, Alan, thank you so much. It was so nice to have you here again and to be able to talk about it all. So thank you.
It's my absolute pleasure, guys.
Thank you, Alan. Bye.
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 You guys, thank you so much for listening once again, or you can watch it on YouTube. And don't forget, we have a special discount for our podcast listeners. You can get the Welcome to the OC book at hc.com/welcometotheoc. Enter the code THEOC for free shipping and 15% off at checkout. That being said, everyone, bye, bitches.